I'm Lauren.
And this is Mike.
And you're listening to Marriage is a Scream. So in our last episode that, at this time it hasn't come out yet, but tomorrow morning it will be out.
So if you're listening to this and you haven't listened to the other one,
you should probably do that.
Back up.
So when we left off, we basically left off at Sylvia's funeral. That was the last thing that we talked about before we...
So real quick, I just want to say that the last episode you listened to with us probably wasn't, well, I can say it definitely was not as interactive as our other episodes have been. That's simply because this is just a tough podcast. There's a lot of sadness and anger and just unbelievableness to this story. So this podcast should be a little bit more interactive because I have tons of questions. The first one I was just mainly listening to the story and trying not to lose my cool, I guess you could say. So I just want to put that in there.
So I want to put another disclaimer at the beginning of the episode. Once again, this episode is not meant for small children. You're allowed to do whatever you want, but it's not suggested. And it's also a trigger warning for anybody sensitive to sexual or physical abuse. This is not as graphic as last night's episode was, this morning's episode, I guess I should say. But it still has some graphic details within it. Sylvia Likens was a beautiful 16-year-old outgoing girl who was tortured for 3 months and eventually succumbed to her injuries in late October of 1965. Gertrude Banachevsky, 6 of her 7 children, and the neighborhood children were to blame. You could also say that many neighbors, her school, and even her parents and younger sister were accomplices. It has been called the most terrible crime ever committed in Indiana. On October 26th of 1965, police arrive at 3850 East New York Street to discover Sylvia's lifeless body. She's covered with more than 150 wounds, ranging from burns to cuts. The owner of the home is Gertrude Banachevsky, a 37-year-old divorcee, barbiturate addict with 7 kids of her own. She is also the ringleader of the months-long torture of Sylvia. She is followed by her own children and the neighborhood children, some of which are as young as 10 years old. No one reports what they see happening. On December 30th of the same year, the Marion County Grand Jury returned first-degree murder indictments against Gertrude Banachevsky and 2 of her 3 oldest children, Paula and John Banachevsky Jr. Also indicted were Richard Hobbs and Coy Hubbard. All were charged with having repeatedly struck, beaten, kicked, and otherwise inflicted a culmination of fatal injuries to Sylvia Likens with premeditated malice.
So in the period of... at the late October is the murder. Then the indictments are handed down within 3 months.
Less than that.
Less than 3 months. So indictments are handed down. We've named all the people we're going to take to trial. And we're headed off to trial.
Yes. So 3 weeks prior to the filing of the indictments against the 5 defendants, Stephanie Banachevsky is released from custody upon a writ of habeas corpus bond.
Who was Stephanie Banachevsky?
She was the 15-year-old. Her boyfriend is Coy Hubbard.
Oh, okay.
Her attorney pretty much convinces the court that they have no evidence that she did anything to cause Sylvia's death, therefore she can't be held. Stephanie waives her immunity from any potential impending prosecution while agreeing to testify against her family and any other individuals charged with abusing and murdering Likens.
She turned state's witness.
So, this is Paula's signed statement. Paula was probably on the same level as Gertrude, if not worse. I mean, Gertrude's worse just because she was the adult in charge.
How old was Paula?
But Paula was 17.
You know what? She was adult enough to know.
So, this is her signed statement. They ask her, "Will you tell us in your own words what you know about Sylvia Likens regarding the facts leading up to her death?" She says, "Yes, I will." The question, "When did Sylvia Likens and her sister Jenny come to live with you?" Around July 4th of 1965, both girls stayed overnight. Mr. Likens wanted my mom to care for both girls while he and his wife traveled state to state working for fairs. Did you ever punish or strike Sylvia Marie Likens? Yes. My dad gave my mom a man's police belt to punish us kids with, and in 3 months, I beat Sylvia Likens with this police belt about 25 times on her butt, leaving bruises. On the 1st of August, 1965, I broke my wrist when I hit Sylvia Likens in the jaw, leaving a bruise. I've pushed Sylvia Likens several times down the stair steps. I knocked her down the stairs once. I've thrown a Coke bottle at Sylvia Likens, and I've given her a black eye.
And this girl just confesses right out to this.
Yeah. Will you tell us where Sylvia Likens slept in your home? Yes, upstairs with the girls until the past week and a half. Sylvia Likens wet and shit on the bed. This is the actual signed statement.
Okay.
Just so we're clear. So mom made her sleep on a pad in the basement, and she was kept down in the basement in the daytime.
The reason she was wetting the bed was all the abuse. The damage.
Probably damage done to her kidneys. That's correct. Have you ever seen your mother beat upon Sylvia Likens or punish her? Yes, I've seen my mom hit Sylvia Likens with her fist on the face. And she has thrown a Coke bottle at her, and I've seen my mom beat Sylvia Likens about 10 times with a board, 4 times during the past week. I've seen mom burn Sylvia Likens on the arms, back, and leg with a cigarette about 15 times during the past week. Mom pushed Sylvia down the stairs several times during the month of September. Will you tell us who placed a gag in Sylvia's mouth and who tied her up with a rope? During this past week and a half, my brother Johnny Banachevsky put a gag in Sylvia's mouth and tied her up about 3 times upstairs in the bedroom. And twice he did the same thing while she was in the basement. Johnny teased Sylvia and made fun of her. Sylvia was tied at the wrists and the ankles, sometimes with rope and sometimes with a piece of cloth.
So is this her statement to the law enforcement prior to the indictment?
Yes.
Okay, so correct. This is not a courtroom statement yet.
Mm-hmm, yes.
Okay.
So, what I'm about to read is a section of Paula Banachevsky's psychiatric evaluation detailing her indifference to Likens' mistreatment February of 1966. She represented the situation as one in which the girl, Sylvia, had become quite withdrawn and negative in her behavior to the extent that she refused to eat and showed no response to pain. So, at a formal pretrial hearing held on March 16, 1966, several psychiatrists testified before the judge as to their conclusions regarding psychiatric evaluations they had conducted upon 3 individuals indicted upon the Likens murder. These experts testified that all 3 were mentally competent to stand trial.
Yeah. Okay. Yes, they should stand trial because of what they've done. To say they're mentally competent, I don't think you could actually say that. They're competent to stand trial, but who does this to another person?
Yeah. So the trial of Gertrude Banachevsky, her children Paula and John, Richard Hobbs, and Coy Hubbard began on April 18th, 1966. All were tried together before a judge at Indianapolis City County Building. Initial jury selection began on this date and continued for several days. The prosecution consisted of Leroy K. New and Marjorie Wessner, who announced their intention to seek the death penalty for all 5 defendants on April 16th.
Good.
They also successfully argued before Judge Rabe that all the defendants should be tried together, as they were ultimately charged with acting in concert in their collective crimes against Likens. And that as such, if each were tried separately, neither judge nor jury could hear testimony relating to a total picture of the accumulation of offenses committed. So basically, if they're tried separately, then the jury won't understand exactly what happened because they all work together. It might make the crime sound like less when divided up.
Yeah.
I guess. I mean.
Yeah. No, I could see how, you know, a strong defense attorney would have a lot of the other testimonies maybe just like not presented fully, or it wouldn't paint a great picture. Okay.
To be fair, though, I think that even divided up and separate, their crimes were
heinous.
Yes. Completely. Each prospective juror was questioned by counsels for both prosecution and defense in relation to their opinions regarding capital punishment being a just penalty for first-degree murder and whether a mother was actually responsible for the deportment of her children. Jurors who expressed any opposition to the death penalty were excused from duty by Leroy New, any who either worked with children, expressed prejudice against an insanity defense, or repulsion regarding the actual horrific nature of Lycan's death were excused by defense counsels.
Yeah, well, you know, that's how the game's played.
Yeah. Gertrude Banachevsky was defended by William Erbecker. Her daughter Paula was defended by George Rice. Richard Hobbs was defended by James G. Netter. John Banachevsky Jr. and Coy Hubbard were defended by Forrest Bowman. The attorneys for Richard Hobbs, Coy Hubbard, Paula, and John Banachevsky Jr. claimed they had been pressured into participating in Lycan's torment, abuse, and torture by Gertrude Banachevsky. So their defense is that these kids shouldn't be held accountable for what they did because Gertrude coerced them into doing it. Gertrude herself pled not guilty by reason of insanity.
Yeah, who wouldn't have guessed that? Right.
So, one of the first witnesses to testify on behalf of the prosecution was Deputy Coroner Charles Ellis, who testified on April 29th as to the intense pain Sylvia had suffered, stating that her fingernails were broken backwards, numerous deep cuts and punctures covered much of her body, and that her lips were essentially in shreds due to her having repeatedly bitten and chewed upon them. Ellis further testified that Sylvia had been in an acute state of shock for between 2 and 3 days prior to her death, and that Sylvia may have been in too advanced a state of shock to offer much resistance to any form of subjected treatment in her final hours. Although he emphasized that aside from the extensive swelling around her genitalia, Lycan's body bore no evidence of sexual molestation.
Wait a minute. Yes, she was. We read about the Coke bottle.
But that, like, I was actually questioning that because what we talked about last night, the coroner basically said that her hymen was still intact.
But, you know what? I was reading after you said that, too. And there is a ton of information that says an intact hymen is neither proof of or against.
Yeah, well, you know that how I feel about it.
Well, I've
said
science.
Stuff about it before.
Well, there's science behind the fact that...
Yeah, but some people don't... There's science behind many things that people don't agree with.
Sure, ask the Flat Earth Society. I mean, we have a whole globe that they think is still flat. For any of you that are part of the Flat Earth Society, sorry if that's offensive, but it's still round. We're still round.
Oh, please stop. I have to delete so many things you say.
It's shaped like me.
I thought you were square.
Yeah, that's right.
So, Jenny Lycan's watching the proceedings of the Banachevsky trial. She instigated the investigation and the subsequent arrest of her sister's torturers and murderers. On May 2nd and 3rd, Jenny Lycan's testified against all 5 defendants, stating that each had repeatedly and extensively, both physically and emotionally, abused her sister, adding that Lycan's had done nothing to provoke the assaults and that there had been no truth in either the rumors she had been falsely accused of spreading or the slurs each had made against Sylvia's character. During her testimony, Jenny stated the abuse her sister and, to a much lesser degree, herself endured began approximately 2 weeks after they had begun to live in the Banachevsky household, and that as the abuse her sister was forced to endure escalated, Sylvia had occasionally been unable to produce tears due to her acute state of dehydration. Jenny said that, so I guess I should just let Jenny say it. At one point, a lawyer asks Jenny Lycan's, "Did you ever see Sylvia cry?" And Jenny says, "They said she did not have feelings, but I know better. I've seen her cry before. But I imagine the reason she did not cry was because she did not have enough water."
So this is her sister saying that?
Yeah.
Well, of course her sister knows she has feelings. She's grown up with her for the past however many years.
Yeah, but she's been told for 3 months, "Oh, you can do whatever you want. She doesn't cry. She has no feelings. She's not crying."
How old was Jenny at this time?
Jenny was, I think, the same age as Stephanie, so like 15.
Yeah, okay. So, you know, I'm struggling still buying into...
Yes, but consider... this isn't a defense to her or anything that happened, but we talked last night about every time she tried to tell somebody, she told her older sister, somebody anonymously complained to the reverend at the church. Anytime they heard about Jenny saying anything, they went after her. Huh. No why would you say anything? All the adults around you who are seeing it happen aren't helping you.
This is like an abuse. No one believes you. This is an abusive gaslighting.
No one believes you. The kids around you, if you say anything about it, are beating the crap out of you for it. Like, what are you supposed to do? So Jenny burst into tears as she recalled how just days before Sylvia died, she had said to her, "Jenny, I know you don't want me to die, but I am going to die. I can tell it." Sections of Jenny Lycan's testimony were later corroborated by that of Randy Lepper, who stated he had once witnessed Lycan's crying, but that she had shed no actual tears. Lepper then visibly smirked as he confessed to having beaten Lycan's on anywhere between 10 and 40 separate instances.
How old is this punk?
I don't remember how old Randy Lepper is, but nothing happened. Are any of
these people still around?
Why do you do this?
Oh, just
I have notes. Just
okay.
It's okay. Just be patient. Okay. On May 10th, a Baptist minister named Roy Julian testified to having known a teenage girl was being abused in the Banchevsky household. Although he had failed to report this information to authorities, as having been informed by Gertrude that Lycan's had made advances to men for money, he had believed the girl was being punished for soliciting. The same day, 13-year-old Judy Duke also testified. Admitted to having witnessed Lycan's once endure salt being rubbed into sores upon her legs until she screamed. Duke also testified to one occasion where she witnessed 10-year-old Shirley Banachevsky rip open Lycan's blouse, to which Richard Hobbs had made the casual remark, "Everybody's having fun with Sylvia."
What a nightmare.
The following day, Gertrude Banachevsky testified in her own defense. She denied any responsibility for Lycan's prolonged abuse, torment, and ultimate death, claiming her children and other children within her neighborhood must have committed the acts within her home, which she described as being such a madhouse.
Right.
She also added that she had been too preoccupied with her own ill health and depression to control her children.
Of course.
In response to questioning relating to whether she had physically abused the Lycan sisters, Gertrude claimed that although she had started to spank Lycans on one occasion, she was emotionally unable to finish doing so and had not hit the child on any further occasions. She denied any knowledge of Lycans having ever endured any beating, scalding, branding, or burning within her home. Two days later, Richard Hobbs testified in his own defense, describing how Gertrude had called Lycans to the kitchen on October 23rd and stated to her, "You have branded my children, so now I'm going to brand you." I gave that whole testimony yesterday.
Yeah, I've never heard of it.
Not yesterday. Well,
right.
For you guys, episode. It's not yesterday. For me, it was like 2 days ago. Hobbs testified Gertrude had begun etching the insult into Lycan's abdomen before asking him to finish the task. Although Hobbs testified this act of branding had brought blood to the surface of Lycan's flesh, and that Sylvia had begged him to stop, he remained adamant the section of branding he had inflicted had been light.
Yeah, okay. I'm not sure what a light branding is.
So I've seen the pictures. Yeah, no, it wasn't just a little tiny scratch.
It was a hot needle.
Yeah. It looks like he literally just dug it into her skin and whatever. Like, that's crap. Hobbs further testified that he had initially believed Lycan's would not be at the Banachevsky household on October 26th, as Gertrude had informed him she intended to get rid of Sylvia the day prior. When Marie Banachevsky was called to the stand as a witness for the defense, she broke down and admitted that she had heated the needle. So I read her whole entire testimony. She went on twice. She lied so many times in the beginning, saying her mom never did anything to Sylvia, that the other kids did. She just freaking lied her head off. Said that she had no part in any of the branding or anything. And it was all crap.
Right.
She just lied. And actually, I believe she's the only one who full out lied. and finally broke down and told the truth.
Oh, other than Gertrude. Actually, full out lied. Gertrude full out lied.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean of the kids. Down. I mean of the kids. Oh. So she breaks down crying and finally admits that she did heat the needle, which Hobbs had used to brand Lycan's abdomen. Marie also testified as to her mother's indifference to Lycan's evident distress in relation to the physical and mental abuse she had increasingly suffered with her mother's full knowledge, stating that on one occasion Gertrude had simply sat upon a chair and crocheted as she watched a neighborhood girl named Anna Sisko attack Lycan's. Yeah. And it must be the truth. So they had issues with this because...
Did this Anna Sisko girl testify?
I don't think so. I'm not sure. I don't remember. But Marie, there was complications with that because they told all of the lawyers that they were not to have contact. Gertrude's lawyer was not to have contact with any of the children.
Oh.
And at one point, he sat in a room with Marie, basically alone, for 20 minutes. And so they think that he kind of told her to lie.
Yeah, he was coaching.
Yeah. Marie added that although all five defendants had repeatedly physically and mentally tormented Lycan's, she had most often witnessed her mother and sister committing these acts before her mother had forced Lycan's to live in the basement, where the abuse had further escalated and she had ultimately died. Another witness to testify on behalf of the prosecution, Grace Sargent, stated how she had sat close to Paula on a church bus and had heard her openly bragging about breaking her own wrist due to the severity of a beating she had inflicted to Lycan's face.
Well, and she testified that to herself. She said that in her statement, I broke my wrist hitting her.
Yeah, but Paula is openly bragging about it to several people in the community, and still, no one does anything. No one says anything or reports it.
I said that. I said Paula, the entire community is complicit.
Paula finished bragging about this by saying, I tried to kill her.
So I said the entire community is complicit.
On May 16th, a court-appointed doctor named Dwight Schuster testified on behalf of the prosecution. When questioned by Leroy New as to the exhaustive interviews and assessments he had conducted with Gertrude, she had been evasive and uncooperative. Dr. Schuster testified as to his belief that Gertrude was sane and fully in control of her actions, adding that she had been sane in October 1965 and remained sane to this date. Dr. Schuster was subjected to over 2 hours of intense cross-examination by Gertrude's lawyer, William Erbecker, although he remained steadfast that Gertrude was not and had never been psychotic.
Right.
Yeah, so that's where we are. We're going to take a really quick break, and then we're going to go into closing arguments.
Back after a quick break.
Okay, so we're going to get into the closing arguments. Deputy Prosecutor Marjorie Wessner delivered the state's closing argument before the jury on behalf of the prosecution. As each defendant, except Richard Hobbs, remained impassive, Wessner recounted the continuous mistreatment Lycan's had endured before her death, emphasizing that at no point had Lycan's either provoked any of the defendants or received any medical care beyond occasionally having margarine rubbed into scalded sections of her face and body.
They rubbed butter as medical care?
I guess so.
Okay.
Referencing specific forms and means of abuse and neglect of the defendant's hands and their collective failure to either help Lycan's or deter each other from mistreating her, Wessner described Lycan's abuse as stomach-wrenching and compared her treatment at the hands of all five defendants as being the equivalent in severity to that committed against prisoners in Nazi concentration camps. There was practically no fat on Sylvia's body. She hadn't eaten for a week. We'll never know the pain and suffering that Sylvia endured. The best evidence of that was the picture of her lips. Lips that were bitten into shreds.
Poor girl.
That's just a section of Marjorie Wessner's closing argument. In reference to the premeditated nature of Lycan's death, Wessner pointed the jury's attention to the notes Gertrude had forced Lycan's to write on October 24th, stating, Gertrude knew on October 24th she was going to hold these notes until she and the rest of the defendants had completed the murder of Sylvia, holding aloft a portrait of Lycan's taken before July 1965. Wessner added, I wish she were here today with eyes as in this picture, full of hope and anticipation. So, for those confused about what notes we're talking about,
go back and listen to the first one.
Yeah, you wouldn't be confused if you listened to the first episode. William Urbecker was the first defense attorney to deliver his closing argument before the jury. He attempted to portray his client as being insane and thus unable to appreciate the severity or criminality of her actions, stating, I condemn her for being a murderess. That's what I do. But I say she's not responsible because she's not all here.
Well, this was Gertrude's attorney.
Yeah. Urbecker then tapped his head to emphasize his reference to her state of mind, before adding, if this woman is sane, put her in the electric chair. She committed acts of degradation that you wouldn't commit on a dog. She has to be crazy or she wouldn't have permitted that. You'll have to live with your conscience the rest of your life if you send an insane woman to the electric chair. That is something that I would be completely okay with living with.
Yep, I'm down with that.
That's perfectly fine for me.
Yep, I think that'd be too good for her.
Holding aloft an autopsy photograph of Lycan's, Urbecker instructed the jury to look at this exhibit, adding, look at the lips on that girl. How sadistic can a person get? The woman, Gertrude, is stark mad. Urbecker then referred to the earlier testimony of a psychiatrist who had called into question Gertrude's sanity before concluding his argument. Forrest Bowman began his closing argument in an openly critical manner as he attacked the decision of the prosecution to seek the death penalty for juveniles, stating, I would like to have an hour of the jury's time to explain why 16-year-olds and 13-year-olds should not be put to death, refraining from acknowledging the catalog of atrocities each had inflicted upon Lycan's. Bowman repeatedly emphasized his client's age, stating each was only guilty of assault and battery before seeking a verdict of not guilty for each youth.
So, you know, I can understand, you know, these kids have no prior, nothing. They've never been bad kids, and they've gone down this path. Now, I can understand some, I guess it's not mercy, I don't know, steering them away from the death penalty, but I don't think it absolves them from the capital crime they committed. I think they should.
If you're grown up enough to tie up a 16-year-old girl and torture her the way that they did.
Knowingly torture. I mean, just like premeditated, plan out things and torture.
All while still going to church and everything else.
Yeah, and putting on the face of, I am a good kid.
Not even, because you know what? They all sat there bragging about it, which says that they knew that it was wrong.
Yep.
They knew it was wrong, they knew they shouldn't be doing it, and they did it anyways. George Rice began his closing argument by decreeing the fact Paula and the other defendants had been tried jointly, sidestepping the multiple instances of testimony delivered at trial describing Paula and her mother as by far the most enthusiastic participants in Lycan's physical abuse. That's not to say that the other ones weren't enthusiastic, because clearly they were.
They were selling tickets.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, so for those who didn't listen to episode one, they were charging neighborhood kids 5 cents a piece to come down and see Sylvia's body and to further torture and mutilate her. So, Rice claimed the evidence presented against his client did not equate to her actual guilt of murder. She literally signed a statement talking about everything that she did.
Yep.
He then ended his closing argument with a plea for the jury to return a verdict of not guilty on a girl who had gone through the indignity of being tried in an open court.
The indignity of being tried in an open court.
What about the indignity of
Sylvia?
Stripping Sylvia down and continuously kicking her in the genitals and doing whatever else she did to her.
Yeah, right.
Telling everyone that she was a prostitute and pregnant while she herself was pregnant by a married man. James Netter began his closing argument in defense of Richard Hobbs by referring to the loss of Likens, stating, "She had a right to live. In my own heart, I cannot remember a girl so much sinned against and abused." He then referred to Hobbs' courage in opting to testify in his own defense and the savage and relentless cross-examination to which he had been subjected by Leroy New.
Oh, please.
Netter attempted to portray his client as a follower-type personality who had acted under the control of Gertrude Banachevsky, suggesting that had he not carved part of the profane insult into Lycan's abdomen at Gertrude's request, Hobbs could well have been a state's witness as opposed to Stephanie Banachevsky. Netter ended his closing argument by requesting a verdict of not guilty, stating Hobbs was guilty of immaturity and gross lack of judgment, but not of the crime of murder.
He was totally complicit.
Yeah. I'm sorry, how do you sit there and carve those words into someone's stomach and then say that you're not?
Even to watch other people do the things and not tell anyone. And not, right.
Yeah. Well, you know what? It sounds like they were telling people. It sounds like they were telling other people. And just no one cared. They bragged about it openly on a bus. Are you telling me that no adults heard this? Like, in the first episode, we talk about how the neighbors heard her screaming in the basement and beating on the wall at 3 a.m.
That was the night of her death, though.
Yeah, and they didn't do anything.
Yeah.
They talked about how neighbors had come over and seen Paula abusing Sylvia and still did nothing about it.
Hey,
the school sent the nurse over to check on Sylvia, and the nurse put in the file not to do a follow-up.
Every one of these people have to live with what they did. That's the most justice that I think you're going to see out of this.
Leroy New rebutted the defense counsel's closing arguments by promising to speak through the mangled and shredded lips of Sylvia Likens, outlining the catalog of mistreatment Likens had endured prior to her death at the hands of each of the defendants. New directly addressed criticism he had earlier received from Forrest Bowman in his closing argument regarding the prosecution cross-examining children, stating, "The prosecutor's job is to present the evidence to the best of our ability. Now let's look at some of the responsibilities here. Each one of the five defendants had first and foremost the responsibility to leave Sylvia Likens alone.
Right.
We had the responsibility to bring all the evidence we could find that could explain this crime." Referring to the sentimental closing arguments made by various defense counsels regarding reasoning and motivation for their clients' actions, their attempts to divert responsibility to other defendants or participants, and their clients' collective failure to either help Likens or to notify authorities, New added, "All we hear is whining appeal, anything but blame where the blame belongs."
Yep.
He then speculated as to the reasons Likens did not try and escape from the Banachevsky household prior to the abuse increasingly escalating in the final weeks of her life, stating, "I think she trusted in man. I think she did not believe these people would do this and continue to do it."
This is sad.
New concluded his closing argument by emphasizing the defendants' unison in their collective mistreatment of Likens. Before asking the jury to dismiss arguments made by various defense counsels regarding who may have actually inflicted the fatal blow to Likens' head, stating, "Every mark on that girl's body contributed directly to her death, and that was testimony. The subdural hematoma was the ultimate blow. This is the most hideous thing Indiana has ever seen, and I hope will ever see." Stating that not a shred of evidence had been produced indicating any defendant was suffering from a form of mental illness, New again requested the death penalty for each defendant, stating to the jury, "The issue here is not about the electric chair or a hospital, but about law and order. Will we shy away from the most diabolical case to ever come before a court or jury? If you go below the death penalty in this case, you will lower the value of human life by that much for each defendant. The blood of this girl will forevermore be on their souls."
I agree with that.
So, we're going to move into the convictions. The trial of the five defendants lasted 17 days before the jury retired to consider its verdict. On May 19, 1966, after deliberating for 8 hours, the panel of 8 men and 4 women found Gertrude Banachevsky guilty of first-degree murder, recommending a sentence of life imprisonment. Paula Banachevsky was found guilty of second-degree murder, and Hobbs, Hubbard, and John Banachevsky Jr. were found guilty of manslaughter. Upon hearing Judge Rabe pronounce the verdicts, Gertrude and her children burst into tears and attempted to console each other. As Hobbs and Hubbard remained impassive. On May 25th, Gertrude and Paula Banachevsky were formally sentenced to life imprisonment.
So Gertrude and Paula got life?
No, they didn't. Oh. It says they did, but they did not. The same day, Richard Hobbs, Coy Hubbard, and John Banachevsky Jr. each received sentences of 2 to 21 years to be served in the Indiana Reformatory.
2 to 21?
Yes.
It's kind of a broad...
Oh, guess how much they actually served.
2.
In September 1970, the Indiana Supreme Court reversed the convictions of Gertrude and Paula Banachevsky on the basis that Judge Saul Isaac Rabe had denied repeatedly submitted motions by their defense counsel at their original trial for both a change of venue and separate trials. So the whole issue with this was that at the point of the trials, it had been so publicly shared around that they felt like any jury that Indiana came up with was tainted. But the judge made a valid point. This is all over the news everywhere. It's tainted no matter where you're going to go.
So then the defense's argument would easily be, okay, then allow us a change of venue. If that is the fact, then allow the change of venue.
Well, but the other issue was that they couldn't actually try John, Coy, and Richard because they needed everyone there to talk about what everyone did together. I think that was the main argument in that. So this ruling further stated.
So you said the Supreme Court overturned it. Overturned the conviction?
Yeah. So the Supreme Court reversed the convictions.
Okay.
Okay. This ruling further stated that the circumstances regarding the prejudicial atmosphere created during their initial trial, due to the extensive news media publicity surrounding the case, impeded any chance of either person receiving a fair trial. So. That's just basically saying that they thought that because the news had been so involved with the case that neither Paula nor Gertrude received a fair trial because of that.
Setting all that aside, they testified. That's a bunch of crap. But anyway, yeah. Go ahead.
The pair were retried in 1971. On this occasion, Paula Banachevsky...
So they didn't necessarily overturn it. They overturned the conviction and called it a mistrial. The
initial conviction and gave them a retrial.
Yeah, that it was a mistrial.
Which, honestly, that's stupid because now people know even more about it.
Yeah.
On this occasion, Paula Banachevsky opted to plead guilty to voluntary manslaughter rather than face a retrial. She was sentenced to serve a term of between 2 and 20 years imprisonment for her part in Lycan's abuse and death.
Unbelievable.
Despite twice unsuccessfully having attempted to escape from prison in 1971, she was released in December 1972. Gertrude Banachevsky, however, was again convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison. Over the course of the following 14 years, Gertrude Banachevsky became known as a model prisoner at the Indiana Women's Prison. She worked in the prison sewing shop and was known as somewhat of a den mother to younger female inmates. Becoming known to some within the prison by the nickname Mom. By the time of Gertrude's ultimate parole in 1985, she had changed her name to Nadine Van Fossen.
Oh.
Which was a combination of her middle name and maiden name, and described herself as a devout Christian.
Oh, of course.
News of Gertrude Banachevsky's impending parole hearing created an uproar throughout Indiana. Jenny Lykins and other immediate family members of Lykins vehemently protested against any prospect of her release. The members of two anti-crime groups also traveled to Indiana to oppose Banachevsky's potential parole and to publicly support the Lykins family. Members of both groups initiated a sidewalk picket campaign. Over the course of 2 months, these groups collected over 40,000 signatures from the citizens of Indiana, including signatures obtained from outraged citizens too young to contemporarily recollect the case. All signatures gathered demanded that Gertrude Banachevsky remain incarcerated for the remainder of her life. Within her parole hearing, Banachevsky stated her wish that Lycan's death could be undone, although she minimized her responsibility for any of her actions, stating, "I'm not sure what role I had in Sylvia's death because I was on drugs. I never really knew her. Please. I take full responsibility for whatever happened to Sylvia." So that's you taking full responsibility without taking full responsibility.
Right. That's exactly
You saying, "Oh, I don't really remember what I did because I was doing lots of drugs, so it's not really my fault, but right. I'll take responsibility anyway."
But you really can't hold me responsible because I just said it's not my fault.
Yeah.
I'm really the victim here.
Mm-hmm. So they said she was like 37. She looked so old. She drugs. Looked like she was in her 70s.
Drugs.
She looked like a grandma, which, I mean, at this point, technically she is because Paul is pregnant.
Right.
Taking Gertrude's good conduct in prison into account, the parole board marginally voted in favor of granting her parole. She was released from prison on December 4th, 1985.
Wow.
Following her 1985 release from prison, Gertrude Banachevsky relocated to Iowa. She never accepted full responsibility for being the ultimate architect in Lycan's prolonged torment and ultimate death, insisting she was unable to precisely recall any of her actions in the months of Lycan's prolonged and increasing abuse and torment within her home. She primarily blamed her actions upon the medication she had been prescribed to treat her asthma, which that's not even originally what she told them that it was for.
Right.
Gertrude Banachevsky lived in relative obscurity in Laurel, Iowa until her death due to lung cancer on June 16th, 1990, at the age of 61.
So she died 5 years after getting out of prison.
So that's still 5 years. Yep. She got to see her family.
Yep.
And see her grandchildren and whatever else.
Sunshine that Sylvia never got to see again.
Yeah. Sylvia died in a dark basement.
Yeah.
Reflecting upon the news of Gertrude Banachevsky's death and the issues raised pertaining to her sanity at both of her trials, John Dean, a former reporter for the Indianapolis Star who had provided extensive coverage of the case, would state in 2015, "I never thought she was insane. I thought she was a downtrodden, mean woman." Dean has also likened the case to William Golding's novel Lord of the Flies. Although he has stated Lycan's increasing physical and emotional abuse was not a result of children going wild. It was children doing what they were told.
Well, that's true.
Her and Paula hated themselves.
And they projected it.
And they pushed that onto Sylvia.
Yep.
There's no other reason that you would do that to another person. If you're a completely happy person with yourself,
you don't hurt people like
you're
that.
Not going to do that. Following her 1972 parole, Paula Banachevsky assumed a new identity. She worked as an aide to a school counselor for 14 years at the Iowa Beeman Conrad Liscomb Union Witten School District, having changed her name to Paula Pace and having concealed the truth regarding her criminal history to the school district when applying for the position. She was fired in 2012 when the school discovered her true identity. She was working as a teacher's aide for special needs kids.
Jeez. The last thing she needed to be around is
children. Paula reportedly lives in a small town in Iowa. She is married and has two children. The baby daughter, the little girl that she had during the trial, the baby was adopted, but she named the baby after her mother.
So wait, is she still alive now?
I'm pretty sure, yeah.
Huh.
Yep. The murder charges initially filed against Gertrude Banachevsky's second oldest daughter, 15-year-old Stephanie, were ultimately dropped after she agreed to turn state's evidence against the other defendants. Although prosecutors did resubmit their case against Stephanie before a grand jury on May 26, 1966, the decision to later prosecute her in a separate trial never materialized. Stephanie Banachevsky assumed a new name and became a school teacher.
Ridiculous.
She later married and has several children. Stephanie Sarek's dad currently lives in Florida.
Wow.
Following the arrest of their mother, the Marion County Department of Public Welfare placed Marie Shirley and James Banachevsky in the care of separate foster families. Dennis Lee Wright Jr. was later adopted. His adoptive mother named him Denny Lee White. He died on February 5th, 2012, at the age of 47. So that was a little baby.
Yeah.
which the baby was completely innocent in all of this, the only one who was innocent. Right. Richard Hobbs, Coy Hubbard, and John Banachevsky Jr. each served less than 2 years. Less than 2 years in the Indiana Reformatory before being granted parole on February 27, 1968. Richard Hobbs died of lung cancer on January 2, 1972 at the age of 21.
Oh, good.
4 years after his release from the Indiana Reformatory. In the years between his release from the Indiana Reformatory and his death, he is known to have suffered at least one nervous breakdown.
Good.
Following his 1968 release from the Indiana Reformatory, Coy Hubbard remained in Indiana and never attempted to change his name. Throughout his adult life, Hubbard was repeatedly imprisoned for various criminal offenses. On one occasion, being charged with the 1977 murders of two young men. Although largely due to the fact the chief witnesses had testified at his trial had been a convicted criminal acquaintance of Hubbard's, who admitted to having been in his company at the time of the murders.
Dirtbag.
He was acquitted of this charge.
Oh, God.
Shortly after the January 2007 premiere of the crime drama film An American Crime, Hubbard was fired from his job. He died of a heart attack in Shelbyville, Indiana on June 23rd of that year at the age of 56.
Still a young guy.
John Banachevsky Jr. lived in relative obscurity under the alias John Blake. He became a lay minister, frequently hosting counseling sessions to the children of divorced parents.
That's crazy.
Funny how all of these people, like most of them, end up working with children.
Well, you know, listen, I worked for the Department of Corrections for years, and we used to say that Jesus lives in booking. And so many people you see, if they come out, they have found their calling, and they enter fields of social work or religion.
Several decades after his release from the Indiana Reformatory, John Banachevsky Jr. issued a statement in which he acknowledged the fact he and his co-defendants should have been sentenced to a more severe term of punishment, adding that young criminals are not beyond rehabilitation and describing how he had become a decent and productive citizen. He died of diabetes in the Lancaster General Hospital on May 19, 2005, at the age of 52.
Here?
No. Is there a Lancaster in India?
Maybe.
I don't know if it's Lancaster or Lancaster.
I don't know.
All these, we had Lebanon yesterday. Lebanon. Yeah, and the first one. Prior to his death, he had also occasionally spoken publicly about his past, readily admitting he had enjoyed the attention Lycan's murder brought upon him. The injury to person charges brought against the other juveniles known to have actively, physically, mentally, and emotionally tormented Lycans, Anna Ruth Sisko, Judy Darlene Duke, Michael John Monroe, Darlene McGuire, and Randy Gordon Lepper were later dropped.
So those kids got in no trouble.
Yeah. Sisko ultimately married. She died on October 23rd, 1996, at the age of 44, already a grandmother. Lepper, who had visibly smirked as he testified to having hit Lycans on up to 40 separate occasions, died at the age of 56 on November 14th, 2010. Jenny Lycans later married an Indianapolis native named Leonard Reese Wade. The couple had two children. She died of a heart attack on June 23, 2004, at the age of 54. At the time of her death, Jenny resided in Beech Grove, Indiana. 14 years prior to her death, Jenny Lycans Wade had viewed Gertrude Banachevsky's obituary in a newspaper. She clipped a section from the newspaper, then mailed it to her mother with an accompanying note simply reading, "Some good news. Damn old Gertrude died. Ha ha ha. I am happy about that."
That's it.
Yeah. Elizabeth and Lester Lycans, the parents, died in 1998 and 2013, respectively. In the years prior to her own death, Jenny Lycans Wade had repeatedly emphasized no blame should be placed upon either of her parents for placing her and Sylvia in the care of Gertrude Banachevsky, stating all her parents had done was trust Gertrude's promise to actually care for them until their return to Indiana with the traveling carnival. "I see a light, hope. I feel a breeze, strength. I hear a song, relief. Let them through, for they are the welcome ones." This is the poem inscribed upon the granite memorial formerly dedicated to Sylvia Lycan's life in Willard Park, Indianapolis. The house at 3850 East New York Street, in which Lycans was tortured and murdered, stood vacant for many years after her death and the arrest of her tormentors. The property gradually became dilapidated, although discussions were held in relation to the possibility of purchasing and rehabilitating the house and converting the property into a women's shelter, the necessary funds to complete this project were never raised. The house itself was demolished on April 23rd, 2009. So where the house once was, there's now a church parking lot.
Well, that's good. That's what it needs to be.
As a result, laws changed and awareness increased. This is a commitment to our children that the Indianapolis Police Department is working to make this a safe city for our children.
So, look, this has been a sad story. This, I don't want to take away from... Here's the crux of this. A young girl named Sylvia Likens was tortured in a very dark basement. And the people who should have really paid for this never really paid for it. And that's what's sad about this story. I hope that somehow that those who needed to be brought to justice in whatever form that has to be later have been brought to justice, because this little girl just did not need to suffer, much like I'm sure there's many, many other cases out there that hopefully we don't talk about. This makes me miss our haunted house episodes and those episodes. This has been a tough one.
So there's actually a law now that states if you see something like this, if you suspect child abuse at all, you have to report it. And if you don't, you're just as guilty as the person who did it.
I agree with that.
Like, there were so many people that could have saved her. There were so many people that could have done something and helped her. And all of a sudden, the rage doesn't happen until afterwards. Until after she's already gone. So, if you are now at the end of this and you didn't listen to the first episode in this segment, you should do that or don't do that, because I know some people are just listening to this part because it is less graphic than the first one was. And I want to put emphasis on the first episode being graphic. We talk about many, many accounts of abuse that Sylvia suffered through, and it was very tragic and awful. So hopefully we will see all of you guys next week with
next week's what? What's our topic?
With a haunted house. Well, a haunted something. Hopefully that's a little bit more cheery.
That's terrible that I am excited about a haunted house, yeah. Versus
hopefully our haunted house story is a little bit more cheery than this one has been.
Well, it can't not be. So
thanks for listening. We'll see you guys next week.